teranga marie orangi nui e tui honei o papu tuanuku e takatonei o te taiao e afinei ia tātou tihei mauri ora. This is the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM, and yes, it is indeed time for the Green Desk. This week on Green Desk, Mangrove Mitch Correros with shark scientist Riley Elliott about the global decline in shark populations. Riley and Mitch discuss the recent decision made by New Zealand to vote no against the protection of Mako sharks at CITES, and the change in behaviour that he has seen in sharks as a result of human impacts on the environment. To begin, Mitchell asks Riley about the role sharks play as apex predators and how important they are to our global ecosystems.
When we think of sharks, we just immediately think a bit of fear and keep it in the ocean and it'll be sweet, because most of us, our formal education of sharks has been Jaws, and we story over and over and seem to, in this modern age, kind of just laugh at it and realise it is a fictitious movie. But what we don't transition into enough is understanding what sharks actually are, and taking that step to flip the Jaws thing upside down and realise the truth. And to put it simply, sharks are the garbage men and the doctors of the sea. They eat up the sick, the weak, the mutated. They keep predatory pressure on fish populations so that they swim faster. They maintain a population size that's sustainable. You know, they keep everything in check. And, you know, I use this as an example from kids to scientific conferences, is that imagine if we stopped having garbage men and doctors in our society. Our streets would fill up with garbage, we get sick, and then there'd be no doctors to take care of us, and ultimately society will break down. That's just not an example, that's a scientific fact, and modern science has proven it, and ecosystems all over the world, that healthy shark populations result in healthy fish populations. And you know, a third of the world relies on fish for food. We rely on ecosystems from the ocean to function, to provide us food, water, oxygen, a whole bunch of things. So it might sound preachy that we put sharks on such a pedestal, but when you realise, number one, they're an apex predator, and number two, that they've been there for 450 million years, it's a role in every niche in this ecosystem of the ocean that is really one that can't be taken for granted.
So what is going on with the, like, globally and in New Zealand? I don't know if they're, like, the trends are similar, but what's sort of going on with species? Yeah, we're seeing quite a lot of species loss, hey?
Yeah, well, I mean, we see it in general around the world. You know, with humanity's expansion, we're taking up habitat, we're polluting ecosystems, and we're extracting resources. We're no different to the sharks, but the sharks, being an apex predator, which means nothing else really hunts them, they have very slow reproductive rates. And so when we all of a sudden inject ourselves into that ecosystem as a predator, we're jazzing up 450 million years of stability. There's been impacts in general, like fishing and fear and hatred and, you know, the odd exploitation for flesh of sharks. But the real nail in the coffin for them has been in the last 30 years because of shark finning. And, you know, most people are aware of it, from 5-year-olds to 50-year-olds. And luckily, because the world has become more aware of it, the demand for it has dropped. But the damage has been done. And that is that, you know, there's numbers thrown out all over there, but the vast majority of shark species have been vastly reduced in their populations and to points where sustainability is becoming an issue. So what we've got to do is acknowledge the value of the shark, but then for the sake of legislation and putting in tangible things that help these animals, we need to justify their role financially and ecologically. You know, to put it simple, with a shark like the Mako shark, it's recently come under a lot of pressure. It services a $42 billion tuna fishery. And when I say services, it chases those fish to keep them fast, keep them healthy, keep them in check. And without those predators, those populations start to dwindle because they'll overutilize their own resources. So, you know, across the board, it's about being realistic in how we protect animals. You've got to put a financial value on them because, unfortunately, capitalism is what makes the world go round. And with an animal like the Mako shark, it's very easy to scientifically prove that value. Once you start throwing that on paper at capitalistic, you know, beliefs, you can start to get traction.
Right. And I'm at a loss then why New Zealand consciously made the vote no on the protection of Mako sharks then?
Yeah, well, we'll rewind back to CITES, which is the Convention on Trade in Endangered Species. And basically what it is the UN, it is run by the UN, it's the UN for animals, and animals in trouble. And what it does is all the members, the 183 members, which New Zealand is one of, join up to the terms, just like we're trying to do with climate change and a bunch of other issues. And if you're a member, if you are a member, you have to toe the industry line, which is that you agree that if you trade an animal that's on a list there, it will not adversely affect the sustainability of that population. Now, it gets kind of complicated here because no one, no matter how capitalistic you are, is going to care about tiny pockets of animals in one niche in the world, you know, that's rare and endangered. And let's use a rhino as an example. It's not going to stop the fossil fuel guys. It's not going to stop the fishery guys. It's not going to stop these big industry guys actually caring, because it doesn't really affect what they're doing. So a lot of these charismatic animals we see get voted in quite easily. The reason why the Mako shark was a huge success in that it did get protection, it did get voted in eventually into CITES, is that it's worth a lot of money and is a big number animal in bycatch and tuna fisheries. So you are, by protecting this animal, you are respecting the big money industries, which is the fishing industries. And the countries that voted against Mako shark protection are not, just through irony, the biggest fisheries in the world. And New Zealand is one of those. So we saw Japan, the US, New Zealand, a couple of others vote no because they have big stakes in fisheries. Now, what is concerning about that is the Department of Conservation is who is representing us as New Zealand in these meetings. The Department of Conservation, by its name, its definition, is representing conservation. So it was bewildering not only to scientists around the world, but Kiwis in general, that our department that is looking after the conservation of endangered animals didn't do exactly that for the Mako shark, which was recently listed as endangered. And I don't have to start digging under the skirt or anything. You can use common sense to realize there must be some influence coming into that decision, because when the Department of Conservation got asked to justify their point, it was literally like children's hypotheticals. It was, well, there's millions of them, surely, and they're spread all over the oceans around the world, so how can they be endangered? Well, the point is that they're a highly migratory species, so they cross international boundaries. That's exactly what CITES stands for, protecting the trade between international boundaries. And there's millions of them, yes, but spread across the entire oceans of the world, which covers 70% of this planet. So the context of justification to not vote for them was laughable, to put it simply. And the data that they based their arguments on is in their own documents, the New Zealand fishery documents, acknowledged to be data deficient. They can't make concrete conclusions about the data because it's biased in various forms that fisheries are famous for, which is location bias, under-reporting bias, misidentification bias, and our observer coverage is something like 2% across the global scale. So bottom line is, you got an endangered animal, if you're a Department of Conservation, we should be jumping up at any opportunity to protect biodiversity. And what's unfortunate for the oceans, it's somewhat out of sight, out of mind, and it's that the fisheries make money because they kind of fund things. We see on land a very different picture. In the paper just the other day, Department of Conservation was preaching how huge an effort they're making, and I applaud them for it, about all our bird species and mammal species. But what about the doctors in the garden of the sea that have been here longer than any animal on Earth, longer than trees, and have been servicing our fisheries that are worth billions of dollars a year? It would make sense to conserve one of them when they become endangered.
I just want to turn a little bit, because I know pretty well, I've seen, you know, especially New Zealand First come in and they really eroded work that was being done in fishing regulations and things like that. What sort of regulations and legislation do you think is necessary to come in to really, you know, protect these species?
What we saw by an example like this was it's capitalism coming before conservation. And conservation is about sustainability. You can't have sustainable capitalism without the resources being sustained. So it's like a catch-22. And so I think until people start looking beyond short-term shareholder return on investment, we look at long-term sustainability of resources, because otherwise we're being naive. And the problem with a capitalistic world is that there's a few handfuls of corporations making these decisions, but and they're lobbying and supplying and funding governments and a lot of things like you brought up with New Zealand First. So what we got to remember, and I'm a big fan of this aspect and this approach, is we really underestimate the power of public opinion. We forget that politicians work for us, that corporations work for us because we buy their product. We have the choice to influence these people's decisions. And ultimately, the decisions affect us, so we should be standing up for them. And we're starting to see a bit of a movement on this, you know, with the, you know, the young people's climate change movement. And the girl, I forget her name, but she was in the paper this morning, and she was saying, I don't want you to be recognizing our efforts and how novel it is that us, even as kids, are standing up for this. Forget us. We want you to just be acknowledging the science, the fact that is there, and act appropriately based on that. And that's the real sad trajectory of science these days. Scientists are working very hard with what they've got to produce results. And we used to make policies based on those results because that's common sense. But in this day and age, scientists are not being recognized as well as they should. Implementation of their facts are not following through to legislation. And we're stuffing up the world because of it, to put it bluntly. So we don't have to necessarily change the recipe. It's not about necessarily changing the policies that are getting put forward. It's about ensuring that they're getting implemented. And if they're not, we should be getting pissed off about that and demanding that they do. And it's difficult when it comes to the ocean because, as I said, it's out of sight, out of mind a lot of the time. And until you go to the supermarket and you can't buy a piece of snapper, it's not going to hit the average person, you know, where they enjoy it. So, you know, but we want to act before those kind of scenarios play out. So it's up to the marine biologists, the conservationists of the oceans, to bring the facts that we do get from the out-of-sight, out-of-mind ocean and bring it to the public to empower that opinion to demand those changes and also work with the fisheries because it's not the fishermen who's doing something wrong. Just like dairy farmers aren't criminals because polluting waterways, it's about the overarching corporates that pay those guys and ensuring that the finances work well enough that they can make a living doing their job responsibly. Because fishermen, just like farmers, know how to grow grass. They know how to care for an ecosystem. It's when they get pushed into a corner financially and they've got to cut the way they act responsibly in order just to make a living that we start having these problems. And there are solutions like in the dairy industry using hemp, for example, for repairing planting and all the byproducts can help that ecosystem, just like in fisheries. But we seemingly have to capture the vision with things like the cameras on board to kind of highlight these things that are out of sight, out of mind, so much so that the dramatic imagery actually lands on the plate of the consumer and they go, whoa, I don't like that, just like we don't like factory farm eggs. We want free range now, and we've beautifully transitioned there. And that is where the, unfortunately, things like New Zealand First really putting a clamp down on not putting cameras on boats was totally unjustified. And I myself am personally working with commercial fishermen to hear their voices, what they can and can't do, and implement things that actually work. And presently working, you know, through corporate alignment with a company called Part-Time Rangers to try and empower the public to fund policy that goes directly to fishermen and makes a tangible difference right then and there. And we're soon to announce that policy, and it's something that I see can happen quite easily. We just have to approach these things in ways that go beyond relying on politicians or being lobbied by corporations to do the right thing.
I've just got a question about maybe moving away from the politics and thing, but so obviously shark stocks are declining and, you know, we're having these pressures from fishing. Have you, over the time you've been studying sharks, seen a change in behavior and forcing them to do or act differently because of these changes in their environment?
Yeah, I mean, massively. There's, you know, people bring up the thing that shark attacks are increasing. And look, it's a silly statistic because so are the people in the water. So you got to give context to things. But what we have seen are particular scenarios where very much human impact is causing adverse behaviors towards from sharks. A real simple example being Reunion Island, where there's been just a smorgasbord of fatal shark attacks in the last 10 years. to the point where it was affecting tourism so bad they banned surfing, and it's illegal to go surfing in this like epic surf destination. And that's not good for the guys who live there and love the water. But the government was like, well, what do you want us to do? Every time someone goes in, they're dying from these bull shark attacks. And a scientist went and did a really cool, it's actually a Shark Week documentary that's coming out in New Zealand in December. He went and applied some simple science, and they found a human impact on the land, like deforestation, clearing land for agriculture, increased runoff, therefore the reduced the visibility in the ocean condition, killed the reef, dropped fish populations down, put all these environmental variables together that basically made hungry sharks overlapping in conditions where they can't see well with people recreating. And so there's no one variable that causes things, but it's these conglomerates of variables that inevitably can alter the behavior of an animal, and that when it's an apex predator, that it's never a good idea when we're crossing our recreation with that. So we're seeing things like that, and again, there was a spate of attacks in Ballina in New South Wales, Australia, and there was a sardine fishery that was fished out there years ago, and it rebounded because they stopped, you know, fishing it. And then again, with industrial deforestation, clearing land, you know, concrete jungles, runoff was causing more turbidity, and all of a sudden a food resource came back, overlapped with people's recreation in bad conditions, which is where surfers generally go. And you've got sharks there, people, and bad variables, and you have a spate of attacks. So there's generally in nature a simple biological explanation to everything. Until you reveal that, the media will continue to run stories that just have no context. So it's important for media to run stories, but we need to get context into things so humans understand how we can responsibly engage with our environment and understand that if you want to go do something in that environment, you accept the risk. Because as a surfer myself, and almost every surfer or person I've seen have a shark attack and survive, they respect sharks more. They accept the risk of going into a wild environment, just like, you know, a tennis player would have to if they wanted to, some reason, play tennis in the savannas around lions. You know, it's common sense.
Definitely, definitely. So, and it's to my, I don't know if I'm completely right here, but it's to my understanding that sharks don't actually really want to attack humans, right? Like, we're not
not at all. Like, people fear them, so they don't want to believe that because it's easy to justify your fear. But let me put it this way. Everyone would accept that a shark's pretty good at doing what it does. They catch seals, they catch tuna, they catch all these hard things to catch. We are incredibly useless in the ocean. So if they wanted to be eating us, they'd be eating us every day because we're that easy to catch.
Yeah.
And there's that many of us. So just the simple fact that, you know, 5 to 10 fatal attacks happen a year with the billions of people in the water, it just proves that sharks, if anything, are very good at not attacking us.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihei Modi Order.